All righty. We're ready to go here. Session 68, lesson 13, page 36 in your outline. All righty. Let's do a quick review of where we were last week. Last week found us where? In the Garden of Gethsemane. Yeshua had made it through his time of agony, where he was sorely tempted in the garden, and he was the anticipation of the wrath of God was bearing down on him, and it was so intense that his physical frame was on the verge of collapse. He was sweating blood. But he came through that time, and then Judas led the multitude of soldiers and priests and Pharisees to the Garden of Gethsemane to arrest him. And we asked the question, or we talked about, I should say, we talked about the fact that there are going to be 21 Mishnaic laws violated during the course of the trial and the arrests. And the question was, why would the Sanhedrin be eager, why would the Pharisees be eager to violate 21 of their own precious laws? That's what they were angry with Jesus about. And we looked at that issue, and we discovered that there was an exception clause. And the exception clause is summarized in Yevavot 90b. Basically, the Sanhedrin is allowed to act in extra legal ways. They don't have to follow all the laws on a temporary basis, just as long as they do it for a short time, if there's a compelling reason to do so. And so Yeshua is the compelling reason to do so. Sanhedrin has also already stated that if we let him go on like this, everybody's going to be following him and they're going to take away our place and our nation. So that's the compelling reason to violate their laws and make sure they do away with Yeshua. And so Judas does lead the multitudes to the Garden of Gethsemane, and he earns his keep, even though Jesus twice identified himself to the multitudes, to the soldiers. Still, Judas, who didn't have to identify him, profanes the sacred by coming up to him saying, "Rabbi," and kissing him repeatedly on the cheeks. Again, a sign of respect and homage in the Jewish community and in the Bible. He is profaning the sacred as he betrays the Messiah. And then we'll just follow the arrows on this map. Again, it's not an inspired map, so I don't follow it completely. But he was arrested. He was taken then from Gethsemane to the place of Annas's residence or council chamber, where the first stage of the first Jewish trial began, first stage of it. Now, some think he was taken to the council chamber, and they think it was located in this location on the map, but I don't really think that's probably the case. More than likely, I think they were taken up on the West Hill. He was taken up on the West Hill to Annas's place, Annas's house, where this first trial took place. That seems to be the best decision. The house of Caiaphas and Annas were located up on the West Hill, close to where the upper room was located. So that's where I believe he is. He's up on the West Hill. He went through the trial in front of Annas. Annas tried to incriminate the disciples, tried to incriminate Jesus. It failed. He could find no charges against Jesus. And so he sends him off to Caiaphas. And that brings us up to section 229, the second Jewish phase, the second Jewish trial, this time before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. And we'll start with a little look at the historical background. I have a typo for you to correct. It says Caiaphas served from 26 to 36 A.D. Change that to 18 to 36 A.D. At the top of the page there, under historical background, Caiaphas served from 18 to 36 A.D. Now, I'm allowed 3 mistakes a year, and I've only done 2 so far. But I'm also allowed 7,000 typos. I looked at my contract, and there it was in the fine print. 70 times 7,000 typos. I like that even better. I better look at the wording again. Okay, so I'm still okay. Just go ahead and correct it. All right, now Caiaphas was the son-in-law of Annas. Remember, the family of Annas dominated the priesthood. So this trial is occurring a little more than halfway through his term of office in 30 AD. So let's now read Matthew chapter 26, verses 57 and 58. Page 226 in your harmony. At the bottom of the page, section 229. And the left-hand column. Everybody find that okay? Verse 57. And those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter also was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now we're told that the Sanhedrin is present at Caiaphas' house. And we know the location of Caiaphas' house. This is the church of St. Peter of the Gallicantu. It's the place where the rooster crowed. So it's a very nice church marking the location of Caiaphas' house. Dr. Fruchtenbaum has chosen to call this the Church of the Cock-a-doodle-doo. Which I kind of like myself, you know. It is a beautiful building. Now, again, it marks the location of Caiaphas' house. And if you go down into the basement of Caiaphas' house, you'll go into the storerooms. Remember, it was very common in small homes and large homes to carve out storerooms in the rocks underneath the home, directly underneath. And so Caiaphas was filthy rich from the bazaar of the sons of Annas and everything else. So he was a filthy rich man, so he needed huge storerooms to take care of all his grain and personal items. So you can see as you walk through there the tremendous storerooms that he had carved out for himself. And of course the pillars are left there for support. Now this is the looking up from the cistern in which traditionally it's believed that Jesus was imprisoned, because the Isaiah says he was taken to imprisonment. So it's thought that he was temporarily imprisoned in this cistern for a while. This is the hole leading into the cistern. Normally you would gather the water from there, but it's believed that he was dropped down through this hole. And of course today you have a staircase going down into the cistern, which I'm standing on. And here I'm standing on it looking down into the cistern, and you begin to get an idea how big this thing is when you put people in there. So it was thought he was dropped down there for an hour or two, perhaps between the religious trial and the civil trial. So here is the picture of St. Peter and Gallicantu down from below. And the reason I show you this picture is to highlight the first century stairs on the right side of the picture. Those stairs, you can bet your retirement that Jesus was taken up and down those stairs when he was taken to and from his Jewish trials. So they're still there today. Here's a view of these first century stairs. You can see they're quite worn. They're 2,000 years old, but they're still there and you can walk them, walking in the footsteps of Jesus. As we go up the stairs, this is looking down as we're climbing the western hill. At the very top of the western hill, you can see the full length of the stairs. And on our right, you can see the courtyard of the high priest. So let's walk through the gate there into the courtyard. Here is the courtyard. Now, the construction is new. The construction is modern, but the location is the same. So this is the location where Peter went in and sat down. And if you look closely, you can see some of your classmates there, right? Can you see yourselves? Can you see yourselves?
Oh, I.
Okay. Can you see some of your classmates?
There,
that's you. There you go. That's Marianne. Yeah, in the purple, in the reddish blouse there. All righty. Okay. Well, that's the house of Caiaphas, and the. The Sanhedrin is present at Caiaphas' house. Now, this is a violation of Law Number 6. Law 6 said that Sanhedrin trials could only be conducted in the Hall of Judgment in the temple compound. Now, it says the whole Sanhedrin was there. Well, the full Sanhedrin consisted of 71 members, 24 chief priests, 24 elders, 22 scribes, and one high priest. However, they didn't all have to be present for a capital trial, for a trial that ended with the death penalty, capital punishment. For that, a minimum of 23 members had to be present. 11 were needed to acquit, 11 votes to acquit, 13 votes were needed to convict for the death penalty. So we're not told how many are present, but we know it's not all 71. Minimum of 23 up to a maximum of 69. Because we know for sure that two are not present, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. We know that because we're going to see that the entire council votes for the death penalty unanimously. And we're also going to read that Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea did not consent to that. So that means they were not there to vote. They were not there at the voting. So we don't know how many present, enough to validate the death penalty, but not enough, not Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. So when Matthew and Mark says all the Sanhedrin, apparently what he means is that all those necessary for the trial to be conducted. All the Sanhedrin means all necessary for the trial to be conducted, not every last member. All right, the trial and violations toward the bottom of page 36. Let's pick it up on verse 59 of the Matthew account. We're now on page 227, and we're still in the left-hand column, verse 59. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Yeshua in order that they might put him to death. Well, they bring false witnesses first. This violates the seventh Sanhedrin law. The defense was supposed to go first rather than the prosecution. My question here is, where's John? Okay, remember, John is in there. We're going to see that John is there in the courtyard. Where is he? He's denying his Lord too. He's doing it passively. Peter will do it actively. But they all will deny their Lord. They'll all abandon him. There was no defense, just the prosecution. And so we're told that the whole council was present and was seeking to convict. The whole council was seeking to convict. That violates law number 8, which states that everyone may argue in favor of acquittal, but not everyone may argue in favor of guilt. There has to be some defense presented. That's not the case here. All right, let's take a look at Matthew 26:60, the top of page 37, verse 60. And they did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward. So this is a violation of law number 9. And, of course, this was based on Deuteronomy 19:15, where two witnesses are required. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. And so in this case, the traditional law was accurate. But the rabbis said that they had to agree in every detail. If you take a look at the Sanhedrin, they did everything possible in normal cases to acquit the person. They did everything possible not to inflict the death penalty. And so they said the testimony had to agree in every detail.
How do you know that?
Because it says so in the Talmud. I believe it states, and this is not going to be accurate because it comes from a 65-year-old memory, that there was a Sanhedrin that condemned a man to death, and it was called the Bloody Sanhedrin. You know, they tried to avoid the death penalty at all cases. Yeah. Okay, so there's an inability to gain witnesses that agree in every detail, and that is required. And finally, two witnesses kind of sound the same, but the differences between their testimony disqualifies them, and we can see the differences in the parallel accounts. So let's turn to the Mark account, verse 58, the middle column. And verse 58 is right opposite the gap in the Luke account between verses 61 and 62, because this is we're seeing here the two different stories of the witnesses. So verse 58, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. I will destroy this temple. That statement is a threat. So Mark's witness says, Yeshua made a threat against the temple. Matthew 26:61. Here's the other witness. and said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 years, 3 days. Well, this is not a threat. I am able. This is a boast. This is a boast. So Matthew's witness said that Yeshua made a boast. Mark's witness says that Yeshua made a threat. And by Jewish law, by traditional law, the difference was enough to disqualify the witnesses. Okay? They weren't agreeing on every detail. All right, let's take a look at the Mark account again, verse 59. Again, just in the middle of the break there, just to the right of the break, center column. And not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. And so the initial charge, disrespect for the temple, doesn't work. All right, let's move back to the left-hand column and verse 62 of the Matthew account. And the high priest stood up and said to him, do you make no answer? What is it these men are testifying against you? So Caiaphas now demands that Jesus respond. There's no need for Jesus to respond. Under the Mishnah, he has a legal right to remain silent. So he maintains his legal rights under the Mishnah. And this is violation number 10. There was to be no allowance for the accused to testify against himself. And yet Caiaphas is trying to get Jesus to incriminate himself. All right, let's take a look at verse 63. Moving down that column. And Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Messiah, the Son of God. So now Yeshua is put under oath and asked, are you the Son of God? Are you the Messiah? And this tells us two things about Caiaphas. First of all, Caiaphas knows Yeshua's claims. He knows that Yeshua claimed to be the Messiah, and he also recognizes who the Messiah was supposed to be. The Messiah was supposed to be the Son of God. So he's very aware. Yeshua has very clearly stated who he is. So don't let anyone ever tell you Jesus never claimed to be the Messiah. Caiaphas thinks he did, even though some pastors refuse to accept that. All right, page 38, verse 64. We're at the very bottom of the column. Matthew account, verse 64, just three words at the bottom of the column. Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. You have said. It's an idiom. It's an idiom that in our English language means the same thing. It means yes. You know, somebody says, that was a great race, a great basketball game. You said it, brother. What are we saying? We're saying yes. We're agreeing. And so Yeshua is saying the same thing here. Yes, I am the Messiah. So he claims to be the Messiah, and he says that the next time they see him, it'll be at his glorious second coming. So you're going to see me again, and you're going to have no doubt. All right. Yes?
How will they see him? They're going to be in hell if Jesus comes the second time.
Well, they will see him not at the moment of the second coming, but at the great white throne judgment.
Okay.
You know, which is after the second coming, when he comes in glory. That might be a better way to word it, when he comes in glory. Okay? Great. Okay, verse 65, the first part of the verse. First part of verse 65, then the high priest tore his robes. Now this violates the 11th traditional commandment. The high priest was forbidden to rend his garment. Second part of the verse, saying, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, we now have heard the blasphemy. Now that statement violates law number 12. That law states that charges cannot originate with the judges. They can only investigate charges brought to them. And again, this is a violation of the requirement of two witnesses that agree. Because this is brought by one person. This is not brought by two witnesses. Remember, the Sanhedrin members are judges. They are not witnesses. They are not a defense attorney. They are not a prosecuting attorney. They are judges only. And now they're acting as the prosecution. And no one is defending Yeshua. Now, the charge of blasphemy violates law 13. Because the accusation of blasphemy was only valid if he pronounced the name of God itself. Again, under traditional law. The accusation of blasphemy is only valid if he pronounces the very name of God. And at no time does Yeshua do this. No time does he pronounce God's personal name, Yahweh. So he cannot be charged with blasphemy. Verse 66. Again, the Matthew account, page 228. Verse 66, in the middle of the column. What do you think? They answered and said, he is deserving of death. So this violates law 14. A person could not be condemned on the basis of his own words alone. So this is the entire testimony, Yeshua's own words. That's not allowed. This also violates law 15. Law 15 stated, the verdict cannot be announced at night, only during the daytime. And we know it's in the wee hours of the morning here. Daylight has not come. This also violates law 16. In cases of capital punishment, the trial and the verdict cannot occur at the same time. But the Mishnaic law said they must be separated by at least 24 hours to give time to deliberate. Had they followed Mishnaic law, the verdict would have been pronounced during the feast. That's something they absolutely did not want to happen. They did not want the masses to find out. They were afraid of a riot. Okay, and they sure didn't want Rome to get into this. This also violates law 17. Voting for the death penalty had to be done, according to the Mishnah, by individual count, beginning with the youngest, so that the young would not be influenced by the elders. Okay? So the young would give an honest appraisal. But everybody votes for death here. And this also violates law number 18, or a principle. A unanimous decision shows innocence. A unanimous decision for guilt, in fact, shows innocence.
Why?
But all are present at his death. You ask why? Turn page 39. You're at page 39. Why? Why? I'll tell you in just a moment. By their own Mishnaic law, now Yeshua should be released. All right. A unanimous vote shows guilt. For guilt. A unanimous vote for guilt shows innocence because it is impossible for 23 to 71 people to agree without plotting. It's impossible for two Jews to agree without plotting, right? All right. They recognized that it's not going to happen between 23 minimum, 71 maximum number of people in a capital crime. It had to be a plot for everyone to unanimously agree. And this, of course, was a plot. This also violates law number 19. The sentence can only be pronounced 3 days after the guilty verdict. They pronounce the death sentence the very same night, not 3 days later. And again, if they had pronounced the death sentence 3 days later, it would have come during the feast. The masses would have been very aware of it, and they absolutely did not want that to happen if they could avoid it.
It was a 3 days of waiting period, so they
yes.
Changed
their mind. It was a waiting period, a way to slow everything down. Let's not do this on an emotional basis. Think it through, make sure we're all right. You know, any way to avoid the death penalty. All right, let's look at Matthew 26, verses 67 and 68. Again, we're on page 228 at the bottom of the Matthew column, the left-hand column. Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, you Messiah. Who is the one who hit you?" Now, this mistreatment violates law number 20. The Sanhedrin laws say that the judges are to be humane and kind. And this also violates law 21, which says that a person condemned to death cannot be beaten or scourged beforehand. This was to be merciful to the person. So 21 specific laws were broken. So the very thing they have against Yeshua, they have against themselves 21 times over. But remember, they got their escape clause. You know, circumstances demanded this. It's okay for us to do what we need to do. They have their escape clause. Now notice in the Matthew account, he said he is beat with the fist, he is slapped with the palm of the hand, he's spit upon. These are considered the highest indignities under Jewish law. And each is punishable to a lesser and greater degree. And it's not the force of the insult, it's what the insult conveys. It's the intent behind the insult. Notice here. First of all, to strike with a fist. If you struck your brother with a fist, you were fined 4 denarii. That's one day's wage. That's a pretty heavy fine. How'd you like to lose almost a week's wages for, you know, hitting your brother or somebody? But if you slapped him with the palm of your hand, that showed more disdain. You were now fined 200 denarii. You know, that's over half a year's wage. That's a pretty, you know, divide your weekly, your yearly wage in half. That's the fine you'd have to pay. But if you spit in his face, you were fined 400 denarii. That's over a year's wage.
So,
yeah, yeah. Well, the Romans did that. The Romans did that. So it isn't the violence with which the action is done. Striking with a fist can cause more physical violence. Spitting doesn't hurt you at all, other than it's gooey and sloppy, you know? But it's the insult. It's the depth of the insult that's being considered here. And these judges apparently are participating in this. But are they going to fine themselves? No, they're not going to impose a fine upon themselves. So moving toward the third stage of the religious trial, we see that Yeshua has been condemned on the grounds of blasphemy. They've broken 21 of their own laws. Now turn to page 40. Now on page 40, you see some archaeological slides there. And ironically, we may have found the bones of the high priest who condemned the Son of God to death. So this is a picture of the family tomb of Caiaphas. And there is the picture that you have on your outline. It's difficult to read, but I'm going to read the highlighted area that's highlighted on the screen here. And you can follow along in that small type on your outline. All right. This came out of Biblical Archaeology Review in 1992. 1992 issue of BAR. Fit for a high priest. The most intricately carved ossuary in the burial chamber below and on the front cover. Now that's it. There's the ossuary they're talking about. The bone box, okay? That's the one. That's the picture of it in place before it was removed.
And it's bigger.
Oh, you'll see. Well, yeah, it's hard to tell how big it is from the picture. The intricately carved ossuary in burial chamber lay undisturbed in niche number 4, decorated with 2 circles, each containing 5 whorl rosettes, surrounded by a center rosette. The ossuary bears, with twice bears, with a slight variation in spelling, the name Yosef Bar Kaffa, Joseph, son of Caiaphas. Inside the ossuary were the remains of 6 people, 2 infants, a child between the ages of 2 and 5, a youth aged 13 to 18, an adult female, and a man about 60 years old. Given the name inscribed on the ossuary, together with the extravagance of its decoration, the excavators wondered whether the remains of the 60-year-old man might be those of the high priest described in the New Testament as interrogating Jesus and delivering him to the Roman authorities. And the argument for that is that the term Caiaphas is a family name. Joseph would be his first name. Caiaphas would be his second name, you know. And so we're talking about a family name when we talk about Caiaphas. That is the argument there. So here is the ossuary in the Israel Museum. Now, I didn't take this picture, but I did have the privilege of seeing it in 1996 when I was there. All the other times I've returned, the Israel Museum's been under remodeling, and I haven't been able to go in. Now it's ready to go. So, go to the Israel Museum. Look at the decoration on that thing. 2,000-year-old, and it's in fantastic shape. That is an expensive bone box, ossuary.
How big is it?
Oh, it's about... So big. Normally, the minimum length is a thigh bone, our longest bone. And so it's a little bit bigger than that.
When do they put the bones in there?
After a year. The body would be put in the tomb. It would be left there a year until all the flesh is decayed away and gone and evaporated away. There's only bones left. They'd go in, they'd collect the bones and put them in the box. And then the burial niche would be reused. So that's why you have all these bones in there. Storage place for the bones.
So they take them down to the grave or whatever?
Well, they're just laying on a ledge. They're laying on a ledge covered with strips of cloth. And after a year...
Inside something?
Yes, inside the tomb, which is carved out of the rock. Okay, we'll look at tombs in a little bit. Okay, the body would just be laying on the tomb like it's laying in bed. And then the flesh would rot away. The fluids would all evaporate and dry up. The linen would be in very fragile shape. They just go in and collect the bones and stick them in the bone box. And the ledge is ready for the next family member. So that's the way they use the graveyards effectively. All right, now here's another view of the ossuary. You can see the side view of it, and you begin to see the inscription on the back side of the bone. Now let's take a close look of it. It was very crudely inscribed in the limestone, and they think by two nails that were found on the site. And if you look at the Hebrew... if you understand the Hebrew, you can see it there. Yosef Bar Kaffa, Joseph, son of Caiaphas, written on the bone box. Now, what is it, the bones of Caiaphas? Maybe, maybe not. There's no way we can prove it. It's ironic if they are. Now, we have the bones of Caiaphas. We'll never find the bones of Jesus, however, no matter what some people say. So at the very least, this find is an independent evidence of the truth of the scriptures. This man, Caiaphas, was a real guy, you know, and the family of Caiaphas was a real thing. So it's a great archaeological find. Very interesting. All right, that brings us to our break. So we'll pick it up on page 41. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar. All righty, we're underway with section 230. We're in lesson 13, page 41. Section 230 is Peter's denials. Now, in the upper room discourse, Yeshua prophesied that Peter would deny him three times, and unwittingly, his friend John sets the stage for Peter to do just that. Now, after the arrest, back in section 228, we're told in John 18:15. That Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. See, this is John. This is John, you guys. So John and Peter followed Yeshua into the very courtyard of Caiaphas' home. And it's thought that it was a kind of a common courtyard between Caiaphas and Annas' house. And John gets in without any problem because he's known to the high priest. And John knows the name of the servant of the high priest that got his ear whacked off, right? He names him Malchus. He knew the guy. And the family of John, apparently, and the family of the high priest were friends. And the servant girl recognizes John, allows him in. No problem. Now let's go on. Verses 16 through 18. But Peter was standing at the door outside. See, she doesn't recognize Peter. She knows who John is, but she doesn't recognize Peter. So the other disciple, that would be John, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. So that's how Peter gets in. John vouches for him. Then the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, "Are you not also one of the man's disciples?" So she knows John's a disciple as well. She knows why he's following Jesus. And she asks Peter. She doesn't know Peter. So she asks him, "Are you one of the man's disciples as well?" What does he say? "I am not. I am not." So here's a little illustration of Peter being intimidated by this servant girl. You know, I just imagine Peter is big, brusque, brawny, you know, guy who's not going to take nothing from nobody. And yet this servant girl has got him pinned in a corner with a question. And he says, I am not one of his disciples. Now the slaves and the officers were standing there having made a charcoal fire. For it was cold and they were warming themselves. And Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself. And there it is. There's the courtyard in which this happened. Remember, we saw this a few moments ago. Somewhere in this area, Peter was about to deny his Lord. Question?
I'm just a little slow. You said Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. That was John?
Yes, the other disciple is John.
And where does it say that?
It doesn't say that. We surmise that from the book of John. Okay, because John never names himself in the book of John.
Okay.
But it's very obviously that he's the one, the beloved disciple. Okay.
And neither did Mark when he followed.
Say again?
And neither did John Mark.
Yeah, he didn't name himself as such, but we know it's him. Yeah. All righty. So John brought Peter in, and he's not doing him a favor. He's bringing him into the circumstances that will lead to him denying Yeshua three times. So we come to the denials themselves on page 41. First of all, he's accused of being a disciple of Yeshua, and he simply denies it in the Matthew account, Matthew 26, 69, and 70. So Peter's denials, page 228, section 230 at the bottom of the page. We pick it up on verse 69, the left-hand column. Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a certain servant girl came to him and said, "You too were with Jesus the Galilean." And he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you're talking about." So there's the first denial. He simply denies it, straightforward. It's implied that the cock would crow at that time. It isn't stated, but it would be implied that that was the first cock crow. Verse 71. And when they had gone out to the gateway, another servant girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." So now he's accused a second time, and he responds in verse 72. And again he denied it with an oath. I do not know the man. So now, not instead of a simple denial, his denial has progressed from a simple denial to a denial with an oath. Now this is not profanity, but it is calling on something sacred to guarantee the statement you've made. Maybe he said something like, "By heaven above, I don't know the man." You know, or, "Cross my heart, I don't know the man." Or, "On my me sainted mither's grave, I don't know the man." You know, something like that. He's trying to emphasize, make emphatic, that my statement is true. All right, let's go on to verses 73 and 74. Turn to page 42. Verses 73 and 74. And a little later, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Surely you too are one of them, for the way you talk gives you away." And then he began to curse and swear, "I do not know the man." And immediately a cock crowed. So now he's accused a third time, and the progress continues and gets worse. He now denies knowing the Lord with cursing and swearing. Now, the cursing and swearing require an object. So basically, he calls down a curse upon himself if he's lying, you know. "May fire come down from heaven and consume me if I'm lying." You know, "Cross my heart and hope to die if I'm lying." You see what he's saying? He's now calling down a curse upon himself. Now note verse 73. "Surely you too are one of them, for your talk gives you away." See, Galileans spoke with a distinctive accent. And we have evidence of that in the Talmud, Eruvim 53. I think it's kind of a cute little excerpt out of the Talmud. "The inhabitants of Galilee were careless in their pronunciation. Once a Galilean came to Judea and called out, 'Who has Amar, an ass, for sale?' And the Judeans laughed at him and answered, 'You, thou foolish Galilean, how are we to understand what thou wishest? Is it Hamar, ass, to ride on? Hamar, wine to drink? Amar, wool for a garment? Or Imar, a sheep to slaughter?'" We can't understand. You have marbles in your mouth. We can't understand how you talk. You know, the Galilean accent was very, very pronounced, and they knew it. They could pick out Peter. They could pick out Peter. Now, so the cursing of himself alleviates the pressure of the accusations. But after this third denial, several things appear to happen simultaneously. Let's look at verse 60 of Luke 22. The Luke account, that's the center right column, verse 60, down about the middle of the page. But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you're talking about." And immediately, while he was still speaking, the cock crowed. So the first thing that happens is the cock crowing. Next, the second stage of the Sanhedrin trial, before Caiaphas came to an end, and the door to the chamber swings open, and the eyes of Yeshua and Peter meet. Verse 61 and 62. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him, "Before a cock crows today, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. So immediately, Peter remembers the prophecy, and it tears him up. He weeps tears of repentance. And here's a nice illustration of what was going on there. There's that fire, and the multitude gathered around the fire getting warm. Peter's trying to warm himself, and there comes that third accusation. And guess what the artist did over there on the left? There's a little rooster crowing. So I like that. I like that illustration. So what do we learn from this? Don't get yourself warm with the enemies of God. Okay? Don't warm yourself with the enemies of God. Set proper boundaries, okay, in your life. Carolyn.
Well, could it be perhaps that Peter was just so curious, and if they knew he was a disciple, they wouldn't have allowed him in the first place, so he was trying to protect the Lord and then be unnoticed. See, he may have had another motive, even though he denied it.
Well, whatever his motive is, we're not told what his motive is, other than he's following the Lord, okay? And but the practical output here is that he denied him, no matter what his motive is. Okay, you know, you'd have to talk with Peter about exactly why he did it.
See, he had reasons. So he had, not that he justifies it, but he had
well,
reasons.
Yeah, again, it doesn't justify it, yeah.
He was trying to be curious and at the same time protect his Lord.
Well, maybe. We don't know. We'll have to talk with him. Yeah, question.
Was John still with him there?
Okay, this is the point. John preceded him into the courtyard. John got him in there. John records this in the book of John, you know. Where's John? He's silent. He's silent.
So you can't protect what you deny.
Yeah, yeah.
Curious why if John was invited in because he was known, you know, he got Peter in there, why would, other than, you know, the Holy Spirit and fulfilling prophecy, why would he feel afraid, or he has to deny
you. Exactly. Well, yeah. Well, yes, he was with John, but he does feel afraid. We'll have to talk with Peter about this. You know, there's these accusations. You got the guts to go in there. Why didn't you have the guts to say yeah? And by the way, I'm with John. Why didn't John speak up? Why wasn't John there to defend Yeshua? You know, they're both denying him. One silently and passively. One verbally and actively. And so all the disciples ended up denying him one way or another.
The whole reason they denied that Jesus already prophesied.
Yeah, this had to happen. Has to happen, exactly, because it's prophesied, yeah. And so they are living out prophecy. All right, let's pick it up in verses 63 through 65 in the Luke account. And that's the very bottom of the Luke column, center right column, very, very bottom verse. And the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him and beating him. And they blindfolded him and were asking him, saying, "Prophesy, who's the one who hit you?" And they were saying many other things against him, blaspheming. So your notes say this is the first mockery, this is the second mockery. So cross out that word first. That's not a mistake, it's a typo. I have 70 times 7. So it's the second mockery suffered of several during this night. second mockery. All right, let's turn to page 43. We come to the third Jewish trial, the third Jewish phase, this time before the Sanhedrin. So now they've come to a verdict and the death penalty, and they try to legalize this kangaroo court. They try now to put a legal veneer over this kangaroo court. So they wait for the day to come for a quick trial to legalize everything. And that's thought where Jesus was probably imprisoned in that cistern for maybe an hour or so, as Scripture would predict that he was put in prison, Isaiah 53. But you know, it's really too late for that. So the location, start with Luke chapter 22, verse 66. So we're on page 230, section 231 in the middle of the page, the Luke column. That's the right-hand column. Verse 66. And when it was day, see, now the sun has come up. It's now daylight. The early morning is past. And when it was day, the council of elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber. So again, Sanhedrin meets in the council chamber. So we're here on the West Hill, and they take Yeshua down the West Hill, down that first century stairway, and over to the temple area. Now, we really don't know where the council chamber is. We do have a hint, but we don't know exactly where in the temple he was tried, or this trial took place. All right, let's look at verses 67 through 69. Verses 67 through 69 continue down the Luke column there. They were saying, "If you are the Messiah, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask a question, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." So Yeshua says three things as he answers them. First of all, he says he recognizes they won't believe in him. Basically, he's saying, "I know where you're at. You're judging me. You're not open to listening to me. You're not open to learning from me. You are judging me. Your minds are closed, unteachable." So he knows they won't believe. Secondly, he knows the reason why they won't believe. And this is because you've already decided not to. You've made up your mind. You've closed your heart. So they won't believe because they've chosen not to believe. But number three, "But the proof of my words will come when you see me seated at the right hand of God, when I am judging you," you might add there. So you're going to know the truth of this when I judge you. You're judging me now. The day will come when the tables are turned. I hope that sent shivers down their back. I hope it did. I hope it made the hair on the back of their head stand up straight. I wonder how they reacted.
Are these the same guys that were up in Galilee blaspheming?
Are these the same guys? Possibly some of the Pharisees were, yeah. Possibly some of the Pharisees had, because we know they traveled north to investigate him, so some of the Pharisees here lived in the south. There were a few up in Galilee, not very many.
The ones that didn't get pardoned.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same guys in from the Pharisees, yeah. All righty. Let's look at verses 70 and 71. And they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "Yes, I am." And they said, "What further need do we have of testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." So that brings the religious trial to an end, and he's now going to move toward the civil trial. So, yes, question, Cynthia.
If they all said it, is that a pronunciation of innocence?
Well, that's breaking their law, yes. Yeah, again, that's that law that said a unanimous decision really proves innocence. That's, again, breaking that law. Yeah, same thing. And again, remember, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus are not included in that all. Just all that was needed for this trial to be, quote, legalized. This kangaroo court to be legalized. All right, the religious trials are over. Now, although Yeshua is condemned to death, in A.D. 30, the Jews did not have authority to execute anyone. That was removed from the Sanhedrin by Rome. So they need Judas. They need Judas for the civil trial. They won't have him. Now, I have this Talmud excerpt for you at the bottom of page 43. We'll put it up on the screen. Sanhedrin, Maaseh Sanhedrin 41a. 40 years before the destruction of the temple. When was the temple destroyed? AD 70. Subtract 40 years. Where are you? 30 AD. Okay, in 30 AD, 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the very year that this had to happen, you guys, couldn't have happened a year later, had to happen this year at the latest, the Sanhedrin were exiled, footnote 42, and took up residence in Chanut, footnote 43. They did not try capital charges. Now, what is the importance of the footnotes that explain this Talmudic section? Footnote 42. They were exiled from the Hall of Hewn Stones by the Romans. The Romans took away their authority because, footnote 43, they went to Chanut, which is a place on the Temple Mount outside the hewn chamber where they had temporary residence. We really don't know where Chanut is, but the word means marketplace, basically, something like that. And footnote 45, capital charges could be tried only in the chief seat of the Sanhedrin, the Hall of Hewn Stones. So they were exiled from the Hall of Hewn Stones. That means they could not try capital charges. They went to Chanut. Okay, where are we talking about? I've given you this diagram previously in your outline. You don't have it in this section, so you'll have to find it in a previous section of your outline. But the Chamber of Hewn Stone is along the bottom there, along the bottom of the slide. You see in the circle there, there's where the Chamber of Hewn Stone is located. And this is Rittmeyer's drawing of the temple. That's where the Sanhedrin was supposed to meet to try capital charges. All right, let's take a look at it from the Temple Mount. Here is the temple, and the Chamber of Hewn Stones, or the Hall of Hewn Stones, would be this building right here on the south side of the temple precincts. All right, let's back up a little bit and take a look at the entire, or the southern end of the Temple Mount. Here is the Hall of Hewn Stones. Now, where is Chanut? Again, we're not sure of where it is, but we do know that the Bazaar of the Sons of Annas probably took place in the Royal Portico. And the Royal Portico is south. And we also know that the Sanhedrin met at the eastern end of the Royal Portico. So this could very well be Chanut here. This is the best guess, although we don't have unqualified evidence. So let's take a look at the Royal Portico. We're now standing in Solomon's Portico on the eastern side, looking to the south. We're looking southwest now. And there is the Royal Portico, the most imposing portico on the Temple Mount, the full south side covered by this incredible building. So let's move out and take a look at it. Here you can get a side view of part of the portico. And on the left side, on the east side, you see a building. That would be probably Chanut, because that is where the Sanhedrin would normally meet, since they were exiled from the Hall of Hewn Stone. So let's go inside the Royal Portico, and you see that alcove at the eastern end. That's the place where the Sanhedrin would meet. And also, this is where probably where the Bazaar of the Sons of Annas was held. So that is probably where Yeshua is taken. That is the best guess. And, you know, this is a semi-public area, isn't it? This is a public area. And so they want to get this over with quickly. They don't want somebody wandering in and spreading the news. So they're there bright and early in the morning when the place is deserted. And they're going to have a quick legalization of this trial and this verdict. Alrighty. That brings us to an application chart on page 44. We've reached the end of lesson 13. And we'll pick it up next week with lesson 14. But let's stop for a moment and try to apply some of this lesson to our lives today. Well, we can learn a lot of lessons out of lesson 13. So I'm just going to pick one. I'm hoping that you can find other applications out of the scripture for the events that are happening in your life. But the theme I chose was the theme of the proper and improper way to act. Kind of a generic theme for the overall lesson. And where did I get that out of the biblical data? Well, under biblical application, in this study, time and time again, we see people doing things in the improper manner. Number one, the disciples providing improper prayer support for Yeshua in the garden. You know, he asked them to stick with him, to see him through this. He knew the flesh was willing, but the spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak. And they fell asleep. And he had to go through the agony all alone. Secondly, Judas profaned the sacred when he betrayed the Messiah at the arrest. That's improper. The arrest itself was improper. We saw that it began these violations of the Mishnaic law. Fourthly, Peter's reaction to the arrest was improper. He draws his sword, he starts swinging away, and Jesus says, "No more of this. You're doing it in the improper way. You're doing the improper actions. Remember, spiritual battles must be fought with spiritual means. I could have the Father send 12 legions of angels. Peter, cool it. This is not the way to behave." And then he heals Malchus's ear. The way to behave is merciful toward your enemies. You know, he expressed mercy, care for his enemy there. Then the trials went on, and they were improperly conducted. And then Peter, and we could say John too, profaned his relationship with the Lord by denying him, verbally and actively denying him. But in contrast, Yeshua is the only person doing things in the proper manner that night. In his agony and submission to God's will in the garden, that was the proper thing to do. Not my will, but yours be done. In his composure when arrested, you know, he identified himself. He made sure his disciples got free. Let these guys go. And they did get free. And then in his conduct during the trials, he's very dignified. You know, when he speaks, he reminds them of who he is. He answers the questions. And basically, in a very dignified way, he tells them, "You'll see me again. You'll see me again, but I'll be judged that time." So he's acting in a very dignified manner during his trials. So, personal application. Now, we cannot expect the world to act in a proper manner, can we? No way. We can become very cynical, but, you know, that's just the way life is. But we can expect it of ourselves as believers. So let us put ourselves in Peter's place. First, when we're working for the Lord, shall we draw our sword and charge into battle in an improper manner? You know, impulsively and emotionally? You know, just do what comes naturally? You don't want to do what comes naturally. It'll be improper. Or will we choose to follow God's leading in our lives and make the decisions that affect the direction our life takes in a proper manner, looking to Jesus for guidance and direction? So don't just do what comes naturally, you guys. Stop. Pray. Seek the Lord's will. Now, sometimes time is short. I realize that. But the more we're in the habit, the better we'll get at it. And the more we know the Word, the better we'll get at making the right decisions, even if time is short. All right. So as we apply this lesson personally, let's look at two areas. So first of all, will we work for Him properly? And will we witness for Him properly? Let's live our lives in a way that will bring glory to God. So, plan of action. Perhaps you might want to write down something that will make this application practical in your life. How can you make this a real part of your life starting today, starting now? So anyway, just think about it. I'll give you a second or two there. And, you know, we've only got 2.5 minutes. No, we don't. We have... We'll have 2 minutes and 5 seconds right now. Anybody want to... It's MST, Morris Standard Time, buddy. Anybody want to share anything? Okay. Carolyn?
The plan of action is to look to God in every decision.
Right.
And don't give in to fear.
There you go.
Yeshua did not give in to fear.
Yeah. God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of a sound, disciplined mind. Right. Okay. Cindy, did you have something you wanted to share?
Witnessing to a brother-in-law on my husband's side.
Witnessing to a brother-in-law. Okay.
Right. And he believes that the Bible is nonsense. And yet he continues to ask us questions about what does the Bible say.
Right. Okay.
So we're having a good time doing Exodus 14:14. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent.
Mm-hmm.
And we're thinking of Jesus and how he was silent when he was accused. And so we're not taking any of it personally.
Right, don't take it personally.
With something that will entice him, like a Charles Stanley message.
Right.
Or
yeah. Yeah, it's so easy to do what comes naturally and have him push your buttons.
Like he's asking us a good question, and he's really
yeah.
not.
Yeah.
The Lord after.
Right, good. Yeah, my brother used to do that to me. He used to push my buttons, and I used to react doing what comes naturally,
yeah.
you know? And that's not the way to do it. Yeah.
Legitimate skepticism always leads to faith.
Yeah, legitimate skepticism. Yes, if somebody's looking for truth,
yes,
they will come to faith. You will know the truth, you know? We're to be seeking for truth. Say again?
I love that.
Yeah.
No, I'll take an
offering if I can. All righty. Let's go ahead and close. Let's go. It's time to call it to a close, and I'll pray for us. We'll pick it up on lesson 14 next week. We have 16 lessons, so we're drawing toward the end of the study. Lesson 14 next week. Father, again, we want to thank you for your word. Thank you for what Yeshua put up with on our behalf to be humiliated with the striking, with the slapping, with spitting. And Lord, we also look at what Peter did not put up with on Yeshua's behalf, an accusation. So Lord, help us to take this to heart and to do our best to behave in a way that brings glory to you, even when we're afraid. Was Peter afraid, Lord? Very possibly. But help us to, if we're going to be your disciples and your followers, to stand up for you, even when it's tough, and to say, yes, I believe in him. So let us move forward with that as our determined goal. We ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you guys next week.